This is Thinking About OBGYN with your hosts, Antonia Roberts and Howard Harrell.
Antonia.
Howard.
What are we thinking about on today's episode?
Well, we were talking about infertility the last time, and I've been thinking we have really different practice settings just between you and me, and probably between us and people throughout the country. And so I thought it would be valuable to continue the conversation and talk about treatment of infertility.
Yeah, on our last episode, of course, we talked about optimizing natural fertility, assuming that the couple doesn't really have infertility as a problem. But now we're going to assume that we've actually diagnosed infertility or subfertility, which remember is 12 months of trying without success in a couple who has no apparent problems and who are, or the woman at least is under the age of 35, or 6 months of trying without success when the woman's over 35. But the important caveat there is this is among couples who don't have any apparent problems like menstrual irregularity or other obvious issues that would tend to indicate a fertility problem.
Exactly. But first, what's a thing we do for no reason?
Well, how about sounding the uterus with it prior to the placement of an IUD?
Okay. Well, that goes against how I was taught. So you mean specifically taking what is typically a metal rod, like a little measuring stick that we place through the cervix to the fundus, and that measures the distance that we would have to place the IUD itself with the IUD inserter?
Yeah, yeah, that's what the little metal torture rod.
Yeah, because I'm pretty sure that all of the directions and manufacturer instructions and stuff say you should do that. But go ahead with this.
I think they all do say that. But
yeah,
the purpose of sounding is to understand where you're placing the IUD so that you can place it correctly up against the fundus and then withdraw the inserter. Depends a little bit different depending on the manufacturer. But you withdraw the inserter a little bit to let the wings deploy before you push it against the fundus and pull the inserter all the way out, hopefully holding it up against the fundus. So if the uterus sounds to 7 centimeters, then you know how deep you can go, and you know that you need to pull the inserter back a centimeter or so to say 6 centimeters to let the wings deploy, and you know that you're at the fundus while you're doing all that. But you can get the exact same information, the same measurement with the IUD inserter itself. It has markings on it. Frankly, they're easier to read than the metal sounds are. You just simply insert it until you feel the fundus, like you would the sound, and you can note how deep you are, and you can pull it back a centimeter, and you can do your normal thing.
Well, that certainly makes sense. And it is much easier to perforate the uterus with this rigid metal rod than it is with a bendier plastic inserter, especially if it has a little bit larger diameter like the IUD inserter does. And then if you're only making one pass with an object, an instrument, or the inserter rather than multiple passes, then that also hopefully would translate to less risk of perforation and also just less pain. I still want to argue for the practical advantages of sounding. Maybe we don't need it to know how far to put the IUD in. Like you said, the inserter itself already has those markings on it too. I think, at least for a learner, I think it can tell the provider that the cervix is dilated enough that you can just pass that IUD through rather than trying to push against resistance and make the inserter get all bent. And then maybe it can also alert the provider that the uterus is the correct size for the IUD, because the manufacturers recommend a sounding length of 6 to 10 centimeters for the Mirena and 4 to 8 centimeters for the Skyla. So are there any studies on sounding versus not sounding before IUD placement?
Well, to address those caveats, first of all, I'd say that as far as the size of the uteruses and stuff are concerned, that, of course, is just in the population of patients that were studied. There's no conceptual reason to believe that a Lyletta or Mirena, for example, wouldn't work in an 11-centimeter uterus or a 5-centimeter uterus for that matter. So a lot of things that are in FDA instructions are there because it's limited to the study population. And when studies are done, they make practical limitations on enrollment criteria. That being said, I think that the sort of patient you've described is maybe the young nulligravid patient who has not had her cervix dilated. You don't really know the position or size of the uterus or things like that. And so I'm not saying you should never use a sound, although an ultrasound honestly may be more informative bimanual exams are very limited, particularly when patients are obese or if they do have anatomic distortions or things like that. If you're worried about a young nulliparous patient who might have an acutely retroverted or antroverted uterus and it might only be 6 centimeters, a quick ultrasound before you put it in will give you a lot more information about that than a sound will. In fact, the sound may be the very thing you perforate that small antroverted uterus with. I think there's really no argument for sounding in postpartum patients who have hopefully a very favorably dilated or recently dilated cervix anyway. Secondly, the IED doesn't pass. If it doesn't pass a few centimeters, then you'll know that you need some dilation. The cervix is typically about 4 centimeters long. So if you're having trouble getting stuck at 4 centimeters, then you can always set the IED down and you can get a dilator. Now, I don't typically use the sound for that anyway. If I'm going to dilate, the rigidness of it and the shape of it bothers me a little bit because I have to determine the shape. I may not know for sure if she's antiflexed or retroflexed. And so the soft plastic dilators that are, or os finders, I think work better for that anyway. And so again, that just worries me. I think the perforations happen with the rigid metal, but you don't need to sound them to determine the dilation. If you had a nulliparous patient that you were worried about, you could use an os finder first and be just fine. But there have been a few studies that look at what is called a uterine sound sparing approach to placement. Many of them also show that the cervical tenaculum is almost never necessary. Again, think that population of postpartum women, they almost always just slide right in. Not using the tenaculum and not sounding, it definitely results in less pain and bleeding. You'd be surprised how many IEDs I've put in, like Kylena's, in nulliparous patients and not use the tenaculum at all. And they slide in to 6 to 7 centimeters. And if they are sort of straight positioned, you don't even need the tenaculum usually. I put in about 4,000 IEDs, somewhere over that number. And most of them have been without using a uterine sound, rarely using a dilator, and only very rarely using a tenaculum. And again, that's going to be mostly in those patients who've not had a child before, where I need to straighten the cervical uterine angle out a little bit to avoid perforation. I'll oftentimes use the tenaculum, but I won't close it. I'll use like one edge of it as a hook and just gently pick the cervix up and pull a little bit. And I find that hurts a lot less than actually clamping the instrument down over the cervix. But I will put a link to a couple of studies that validate this approach, which of course was just not studied in the original trials. And that's why the package inserts say to do it in a slightly more barbaric way.
Well, this whole sound sparing, tenaculum sparing approach, it reminds me of the increasingly minimally invasive approach to other things like hysteroscopy. And when I first heard about, vaginoscopy is how they refer to that, I was in disbelief that someone could just insert a hysteroscope without even using a vaginal speculum, without using a tenaculum either, without dilating. And of course, I would like to get more familiar with that technique too. But that is with visualizing the anatomy as you go. So if someone was doing the same thing with an IUD, obviously they would need to have a sense of the uterine size and position, as you said, because they're inserting it blindly. So they don't want to unwittingly deploy it into the cervical canal or just at the very top of the cervix or through the uterus into the abdomen.
Yeah, if you've put an IUD in and you realize, it went to 11 or 12 centimeters, I think you should just stop right there and get an ultrasound. But in fairness, a lot of the perforations happen with those nulligravid patients who are acutely antiflexed or retroflexed. And so if you're feeling yourself having to use a lot of resistance or you're up against a lot of resistance when you're trying to insert it, that's probably also time to take a pause and think about the flexion of the uterus. And an ultrasound, I think, can be advantageous there too. So if they could put a camera on the end of the IED inserter, we could do it without a speculum, but let's not encourage that thought process. So, but you can do hysteroscopy without a sound too. That'd be another thing to discuss. A lot of the perforations happen because of the sounding. So if you're doing an endometrial ablation where you need cavity integrity, you also need good measurements of the cavity. So there's a place to use a sound so that you can get good measurements, but you also don't want to perforate the uterus in the process of that. So I think the sound makes false tracks and a lot of the perforations happen from that. And so if you don't need it, don't use it.
Okay, well, maybe I'll try omitting the sound on my next IUD insertion and see how that goes. And I do really like the idea of just using one side of the tenaculum as a little hook, so still get some straightening out the uterus, but without clamping down both teeth, because that is always painful. So let's go back to infertility. Let's talk about the approach for the workup of patients who have met the definition of infertility that you just mentioned at the beginning of this episode.
Well, the first thing I'd say is that it seems like infertility evaluations and workups are really still the wild, wild west. You see just all sorts of things. A lot of fertility practices have grown their own local customs, if you will, over time. They've standardized a lot of things like what lab panels they get on everybody or things they automatically sort of order on everyone. A lot of practices have also come up with a lot of very unique sort of one-off things that they do, like putting everybody on Valtrex who has infertility or recommending everybody who's getting IVF have intralipid infusions or just a lot of things like that that certainly aren't represented in the broader community of reproductive endocrinologists or based on good evidence. But it seems like almost every practice has some little idiosyncrasy or some degree of way they do it there that maybe isn't the way everybody else does it or isn't necessarily based upon good evidence and certainly may not be the most cost-efficient way of approaching a problem. And I think that's really meaningful in an area where many patients are paying cash for these services, and having a cost-efficient strategy I think is really important. I do think we have to talk separately about the patient who comes to you who maybe hasn't had a period in 3 months and wants to conceive, or perhaps someone who's had a known history of a tubal ligation or tubal disease, or they know the partner has azoospermia, or maybe they already have frozen embryos that they just want to have implanted from a prior in vitro fertilization cycle. These sorts of unique cases where the evaluation workup in those scenarios should be very, very focused and limited to proceeding towards what is already a known cause of infertility. But I'm talking here about the more global, we don't know why we're infertile. What do we do next?
Okay, so we can talk about some of those situations as maybe some example cases later on. So right now, let's talk about the evaluation of a seemingly healthy couple who presents after 12 months of trying and failing to conceive. Let's say that they're both in their late 20s and there's no obvious reason for the infertility, like irregular menses that might make us think of some low-hanging fruit like anovulation.
Okay, perfect. So the goal here then is to get to a diagnosis, in my mind, to get to a diagnosis in the most cost-effective manner possible. And I'll include on the website for this episode a suggested algorithm of the workup that we're going to talk about for this patient. Now, just like in the last episode, most of what we're going to say today comes from another ASRM committee opinion called Fertility Evaluation of Infertile Women that was published in 2021. And so we'll reference that a lot, and I'll put a link to that as well.
Yeah, when we get into answering some of the specific clinical scenarios, we may have to get into the primary literature a little bit, but it's useful for this discussion to be based around the ASRM guidelines because this is something that you really should expect your fertility specialist to be on board with. These are things that really are not controversial. So let's go through their recommendations to answer this question. One of the things I'll point out too is that they list the following as issues that should proceed to immediate treatment. So in other words, if you see these things, you don't have to make them wait a year of trying before you do further evaluation or further treatment. So irregular menses, as we already mentioned that one, oligomenorrhea, amenorrhea, or a known or maybe just suspected uterine or tubal or peritoneal disease like endometriosis, and known or suspected male infertility or subfertility. They include sexual dysfunction in this category. And then any history of things like chemotherapy or radiation that might be a genetic or acquired reason to have diminished ovarian reserve.
Yeah, perfect. For those conditions, if you identify them, then we'll proceed with evaluation of those problems and treatments directly rather than, as you said, wait some year or 6 months. It's not uncommon for a couple to come in after 7 or 8 months of trying. They're frustrated a little bit that they haven't conceived yet. That'd be a great time to do a directed history looking for these sorts of issues, things that you just mentioned, and then provide reassurance if none are found and encourage them to get to that full year before doing more aggressive workups. And it's also a great time, by the way, to talk to them about all the things we said in the last episode about optimizing their natural fertility chances. Sometimes those things correct small mistakes or make things a little bit better. But once they meet the definition of infertility, then of course, evaluation starts with a good history and maybe physical examination. The history is going to be the most important part of this. The history may provide clues that make the evaluation and workup much more directed and focused. It should also include general preconceptual counseling and going over the information we discussed in the last episode so that they're optimizing everything. But in terms of physical exam, I do love the fact that this bulletin says that a complete physical or gynecologic exam is not required because, unfortunately, this is one of the things that's common practice. Doing a breast exam, for example, or maybe even a pelvic exam on a patient presenting with infertility isn't going to yield any useful information about why she's infertile in most cases, but you do see this done a lot at practices.
Yeah, they included a table here of what sort of history and physical might be indicated, and it's definitely worth looking at and making sure whatever note templates you might have for infertility include these things, but I'll summarize the chief areas in the fertility history. Of course, you want to know how long there's been unprotected sex, like how long have they been truly trying to conceive and how often, whether they've been monitoring ovulation and how they've been doing that, and whether the partner has had children before or even the patient herself has had children before, and whether there's sexual dysfunction. And then, of course, menstrual history, gynecologic history, obstetric history, genetic or congenital issues, either with the patients or their families, and then just basic. This kind of makes a lot of sense, past medical, surgical history, medications, and then really elicit, have there been recurrent miscarriages? Have there been birth defects? Any signs of an endocrinopathy? Is there any concern for early menopause? Are there environmental exposures or substances, tobacco or drugs, for example, like suboptimal habits? And then a few things about the male too, whether, especially, do they use medications or steroids or other supplements? Do they have issues with sexual function? They had any prior surgeries and that kind of thing. So it's a long list, but.
Well, you make it sound simple, as if people actually take histories in this day and age, but I will say that most people's approach to medicine is unfortunately sort of the shotgun approach where the couple comes in and they're infertile and the doc has already decided to order all the tests and do all the studies. And so the history sort of doesn't get a focus that it should. And of course, a good history will help determine which tests are necessary. I complain about this all the time in emergency rooms. A lot of times tests are ordered automatically before a history has even been taken or before the patient has seen the clinician. And that's really just not the appropriate way of doing it. The point of a good history is to go where the money likely is and to focus on areas with our limited resources and especially limited budget of some of the patients seeking infertility treatment to focus on high yield areas first and get to the answer quickly. And a lot of times, if you take a good history like you just described, you'll know the answer, or at least you'll have a pretty clear pathway to the most efficient workup necessary to get to the answer. And one thing I like to say is, learning about what prior workups the couple might have had and evaluations is also very important. Another thing I see way too much of is fertility evaluations essentially being repeated endlessly. Patients a lot of times will have a lot of workup with their primary OBGYN, then they'll go to a reproductive endocrinologist. They might not like what they hear, so they go to another one, things like that. And these evaluations get repeated over and over again, and often with this one-size-fits-all approach. They order everything every time. But if the patient's already had a normal hysterosalpingogram, maybe by her primary OBGYN as part of an evaluation, it's really difficult to justify repeating that test or any other test of tubal patency, maybe a FemView or something like that. But I see this unfortunately happen basically every time. And the same for labs. A patient may have already had a laboratory evaluation at their primary OB or another doctor, or even a primary care physician. And repeating all those labs just because you happen to have a fertility panel on your EHR of labs that you always order every time is, again, unwarranted and an unjustified expense for people who may be paying cash. They also have a table there about physical exam and when some of those physical exam items might be warranted, although most aren't.
Yeah, they do, to go along with that history. So essentially, they don't recommend any physical exam unless it's based on the findings from that history. So for example, you might perform a thyroid exam if you already have evidence of abnormal thyroid tests or a history of thyroid disease. You might perform a breast exam if she complains in her history of a breast mass or nipple discharge. And you might perform a speculum exam if she complains of maybe of any kind of pain or postcoital spotting, or if she's due for her pap or things like that. And maybe you'll perform a skin exam if you're suspecting polycystic ovarian syndrome and you're looking for hirsutism or acne or hair loss or acanthosis nigricans or something like that. It specifically says that bimanual pelvic exam is not indicated for the evaluation of infertility. But of course, if someone has suspected endometriosis or large fibroids or something like that, then sure, it's probably a very appropriate thing to do in those cases.
And this is really the way all physical exams should be conducted. It should be done for a specific reason to answer a specific question, apart from some of the very few areas where you do physical exam for screening purposes. If the patient has primary amenorrhea, then a pelvic exam is indicated to look for vaginal septums and things like that, but you should be doing it because you're answering a specific question. Now, that being said, I can guarantee you that if you go see a reproductive endocrinologist for a new consult, you're probably going to get a breast exam and a bimanual pelvic exam, maybe even a pap smear that's not necessary. But we shouldn't be doing tests or physical exams unless we can answer how it specifically will change the management of the patient or how it will help us refine our differential diagnosis. And I think that's a good thing to challenge learners with too. Anytime they do any physical exam or want to order any test, is to make them answer those questions.
Yeah, because you don't have time to do all these unnecessary examinations. Anyway, so let's say we've done a good history and whatever physical exam might be indicated and we still haven't found a specific issue and our patient appears to have regular menses and the history just doesn't indicate any glaring abnormalities. So let's go through the algorithm and use this ASRM article as a guide to move through what testing is appropriate.
Well, the first thing really is to determine whether or not ovulation is actually occurring. Even if the history reveals very regular menstrual cycles, about 3% or so of women with regular cyclic bleeding actually don't ovulate, regularly at least. And of course, in couples presenting with infertility after a year of trying, that number is going to be much higher because you found that 3% of women right there. So confirming ovulation in women who even have regular menstrual cycles, let alone irregular ones, is of course going to be a first step. It's the cause of 40% of female factor infertility and 15% of infertility distributed over the couple. It's also easy to treat, by the way, and very inexpensive to treat once you find it. And it's very likely to be the cause of infertility in patients who present to their general OBGYN with infertility plus or minus irregular menses early on. In other words, those patients who come to you after 5 or 6 months of irregular menses and they don't want to wait 12 months of trying to conceive, you hopefully discover that they're not ovulating and offer them treatment early on.
Yeah, and this document talks about different methods for evaluating ovulatory function, including menstrual history, luteal progesterone, like a serum progesterone, ovulation prediction kits, which are urine LH, and then ultrasound and basal body temperature. And they also mention endometrial biopsy. And I'll just summarize the bottom line for each. The endometrial biopsy is not recommended and really has no ability to distinguish fertile from infertile women. And basal body temperature, we talked about in the prior episode, it's fairly inaccurate and it's not typically recommended, especially for infertile women. Because remember, we also talked about in the last episode that just because some ovulation tracking system works well for a fertile woman who is ovulatory, it doesn't necessarily mean it'll work the same in an infertile woman, especially if she has ovulatory dysfunction. Her basal body temperatures could be all over the place. And ultrasound, it can be useful overall because it allows you to see the adnexal and uterine anatomy and maybe some pathology too. And it can help indicate ovulation if it's done at the exact right time. But they don't recommend that transvaginal ultrasound be the primary method of assessing whether or not a woman's ovulating. The home ovulation prediction kits, as we also discussed previously, do work well with most women, but women with PCOS, for example, might have tonically elevated LH levels, which would lead them to have false positives. And menstrual history alone obviously is not enough, particularly for those infertile couples and the 3% who have regular bleeding without ovulating. So then that leaves the mid-luteal serum progesterone, or really progesterone 1 week before the expected period, as the preferred method of confirming ovulation.
Yeah, it's not really mid-luteal if you have a 16-day or 18-day luteal phase. It's a week before, so we misuse mid-luteal, I think, when we talk about it a lot. But yeah, so get a progesterone a week before the expected day of their next menses, and let's see if she's ovulating. And then the most important thing in the paragraph in that bulletin is it states that a progesterone level greater than 3 nanograms per milliliter is evidence of ovulation. But unfortunately, even fertility specialists often tell patients that the progesterone level should be at least 10. And I've seen this my whole career. It's very frustrating. If it's less than 10, then they'll tell the patient that somehow their ovulation was less than ideal or poor quality, or it's inefficient in some way. It's problematic. And this comes from a very simple mistake. It's confusing units. 3 nanograms per milliliter of progesterone is equivalent to 9.54 nanomoles per liter of progesterone, which rounds up nicely to 10. And much of the work on luteal progesterone was done in Europe, which uses nanomoles per liter instead of what we use in the US, which is nanograms per milliliter. And so when these papers were initially published, and when folks would go and hear talks by these docs discussing detection of ovulation in meetings in the 80s and 90s, people frequently came back and they had the number 10 in their head because that's what they talked about. But they forgot that in the United States, we use different units. So it's a funny story how this has happened. But gosh, it's led to a ton of unnecessary care and concern and explanations for why progesterones of 3.5 and 4 are somehow insufficient and things like that. And just over-treatment for women who are already ovulating.
Okay, let's assume that the progesterone is less than 3, or we have some other reason to believe that ovulation is not occurring, like if they're completely amenorrheic, for example. So that would take us down the left side of this lovely algorithm that we're going to post on the website. So what's the next step in working up the patient who does not ovulate?
Well, the next step, of course, is to potentially look for an underlying cause. A TSH can identify underlying thyroid disease as a potential and treatable problem. Hyperprolactin, well, prolactin itself is no longer recommended as part of a routine evaluation. But if you have a patient with galactorrhea or oligo or amenorrhea, the prolactin level still could be an issue. So that would be indicative just for those patients. In a woman who has regular menstrual cycles and doesn't have galactorrhea, there's no reason to get a prolactin level. And then a follicle stimulating hormone, an FSH, and estradiol levels are appropriate, especially if the woman has amenorrhea or oligomenorrhea. You don't have to get one for the woman with regular menses, but this allows us to distinguish the patients who have ovarian insufficiency on one end of the spectrum from those who have hypothalamic amenorrhea on the other end. An FSH less than 10 with a low estradiol level would indicate a hypothalamic amenorrhea, or the World Health Organization Category 1. And those patients will likely require exogenous gonadotropin stimulation for ovulation induction. Sometimes they can gain weight and maybe cut out their exercise routine if they have the female athletic triad, but a lot of those women are going to need ovulation induction. And then on the other end are patients who have high follicle stimulating hormone, but low estradiol, so the ovary's not responding. So that's a FSH greater than 30. And that's what the World Health Organization calls Category 3. And these are the women who you might find that have ovarian insufficiency or premature ovarian failure, and they may need egg donation. In the middle of those two extremes, or World Health Category 2, is the more typical average patient who will have a normal FSH usually and a normal to high estradiol. And these are the patients, we often call them polycystic ovarian syndrome. They don't necessarily have to be that, but they're the ones who typically will benefit from ovulation induction with either clomiphene or letrozole.
This World Health Organization and ovulation classifying system reminds me of the 3-tier fetal heart rate classification system, because category 2 is always the most common and also the most kind of varied mixed group. And for anovulation, it does include PCOS, but then also lots of other less defined states of hormonal dysfunction that pretty much just don't fall into category 1 or 3, and that also don't necessarily have a clear underlying cause or a cure for the underlying process. And this paper also talks about the role of anti-Müllerian hormone, or AMH, which is very frequently ordered as almost a first-line test or like a test for ovarian reserve, but it really isn't that, and it really shouldn't be ordered for that. The value of the test is really to predict the ovarian response to gonadotropins, but it's not a good indicator of a woman's pregnancy potential or how long she might have left in her life to achieve a pregnancy.
Yeah, and there's just no reason, as you said, to order it as a first-line test. It's interesting. Facebook listens to our conversations. If you search for fertility stuff and you're reading about fertility stuff, all of my Facebook ads, and I'm now looking for them because I want to see what they're selling so we can talk about them, are these fertility companies. And very commonly, they'll offer you at-home AMH testing. And so half of them, that's their miracle test they're offering. And they make it sound as if it can tell you what chances you have of getting pregnant and how long you have to achieve a pregnancy. And those are two things that it exactly cannot tell you. It has a small role in deciding about proceeding with gonadotropin injections, but probably not a better role than things like resting antral follicle counts and things like that. So other testing at this point, and we've decided that you've got an ovulation, we've categorized you based upon the three categories there with the use of an FSH and an estradiol. We've looked at your thyroid or prolactin if indicated. So other testing at this point really should be based upon the findings. So for example, if you've suspected androgen excess, particularly virilization or something like that, then you might do additional testing for 21-hydroxylase deficiency, non-classical adrenal hyperplasia. But that would follow the initial testing. It's not something you're just going to order on every patient every time. And it should be based upon your clinical suspicion after you've taken a history and done the initial evaluation.
All right. Well, so far in this hypothetical case, we've only ordered mid-luteal progesterone, and it was negative. So then we ordered an FSH, estradiol, TSH, and maybe a prolactin if she had nipple discharge, for example. But when the typical woman goes to the REI, they're probably getting a whole bunch more tests than that. And they're usually all ordered at the first visit.
Yeah, in addition to the anti-Müllerian hormone, which we can talk about later on, but I think has become a tool of abuse. But yeah, there are lots of other things that might be ordered routinely that look for either some cause of infertility or maybe prepare you for some phase of assisted reproductive technology that might be appropriate, but they don't necessarily need to be done at the beginning for a basic evaluation. It should be done when you're going down that pathway. Again, the point here is not to order every single test that could ever be necessary at any time, but to find a cost-efficient and effective way to evaluate the causes of infertility and provide treatment. So as we said, the anti-Müllerian hormone would be a good example of that. It may have a role later on in a subset of women who are considering in vitro fertilization versus donor egg, but it doesn't have any role larger than that. And even that role is not well defined. But like I said, I think it's being used to encourage women to proceed with earlier and more aggressive treatments because they're scared into thinking that an abnormal AMH is a sign of rapidly diminishing fertility, and it just isn't. So there's no logical reason to order it up front. It doesn't change the initial workup or pathway unless you're using it to manipulate people into doing tests into doing IVF when they shouldn't. Now, other commonly ordered tests or potential parts of a workup I've seen include some of the standard prenatal labs like rubella. Well, that can make some sense because you could treat them for rubella or immunize for rubella, I should say, prior to doing the workup. So that's why that's sometimes done. But also they include things like cystic fibrosis screening or SMA screening or Fragile X screening. Now, I think what happens with the cystic fibrosis or the spinal muscular atrophy screening or even the Fragile X is that patients who might be carriers for these genetic diseases, and you could add other ones too. They're encouraged to get genetic counseling before conception and potentially go straight to in vitro fertilization with pre-implantation genetic diagnosis rather than maybe a simpler method of getting pregnant might be appropriate for them, like ovulation induction or intrauterine insemination. But that might have resulted in a pregnancy, and their argument is that it would somehow be unethical to help a person get pregnant whose child might have one of these diseases. But, you know, really, it's unethical to not offer treatments that are cost-effective and simpler to patients who are carrier of these diseases. When women with normal fertility are contemplating a pregnancy, they come see you for preconceptual counseling. We don't tell them that they should go get screened for all of these 100 different genetic tests that testing is available for. And then if any of them are positive, then their partner should get tested. And if they have both carriers, they should forego natural fertility attempts and get their tubes tied or something to force them into in vitro fertilization with pre-implantation and genetic diagnosis. But it seems if someone goes to the reproductive endocrinologist, sometimes they're refusing treatment. I've heard of several practices refusing to even see a patient who won't consent to a cystic fibrosis or SMA screen. I think that's wrong. If someone is a known carrier or has a family history of any disease that's genetic, and they're counseled that preimplantation genetic diagnosis is a way of not passing that gene on, and they want to pursue that, then go ahead. But denying treatment to someone because they happen to be a cystic fibrosis carrier, I think that's unethical.
Yeah, thankfully, I mean, that sounds really extreme. I have not seen it that being like a either get this or get out of my office kind of thing. But I think it's nice to offer it because if they're coming to an REI and they might be getting IVF anyway, then...
And right, if they're going down the pathway of IVF, doing one of the screening carrier tests actually makes financial sense, even at the cost of pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. Skipping implanting embryos that have a known genetic defect is actually going to save them time and money and cycles to lower the rate of miscarriage. But in a couple who just needs ovulation induction, and that's all they need to get pregnant, that is where it's being used as a weapon against them, perhaps.
Well, and then some other labs that I commonly see, and you probably do too, are testosterone levels, DHEAS, androstenedione, sex hormone binding globulin, and there's probably a few others in there. And of course, these might be appropriate for some patients, but not as a general initial screen for everybody. So let's go back to the top of this algorithm. What if the progesterone was normal? It was more than 3, and she does ovulate. In that case, we suggest that the next step is a semen analysis.
Yeah, just in terms of a stepwise and cost-efficient approach, that's certainly what makes the most sense. Male factor infertility accounts for over half of infertility among couples. So if a couple's setting in front of you, there's a little bit better than 50% chance that he's the problem or a part of the problem. Now, the actual workup of the causes of male factor infertility is certainly beyond the scope of what we're talking about here in this episode or maybe this podcast. But the nice thing is that almost all of those you can figure out if you need to go down that just by doing a sperm analysis. So the sperm analysis is either going to be good or it isn't. And if it isn't, there's a whole lot of extra workup to do to figure that out. Lots of different causes. But if it's good and he's able to ejaculate in the vagina with some regularity, then we can essentially exclude the male as being a source of infertility. And the best way to do this is with a sperm analysis. The ASRM recommends that the man and the woman undergo concurrent evaluation. This means they would recommend that the couple presenting with a year of infertility have both a workup for ovulation in the woman and a sperm analysis at the same time. And I don't think that's unreasonable at all, considering that the male will be the problem over half the time, and that an ovulatory disorder in the woman will be the problem in over 15% of the time, and they may both have a problem. Then just those two steps alone, you've excluded about 2/3 of the causes of infertility. And because both may have a problem, testing at the same time makes a lot of sense. Again, it's been a year and they're trying to get pregnant. Let's get it over with. But it's also true that many times couples who are seeing their primary OBGYN for infertility, they don't have the money for a sperm analysis. So in particular, when irregular menses are present and it's clear that ovulation is the issue, well, it's reasonable to offer the woman Clomid or letrozole to induce ovulation for some period of time, maybe 6 months or something, before proceeding with a sperm analysis if cost is an issue for them. That being said, a sperm analysis is about the cheapest thing you can do in an infertility workup, and so considering it covers half the battle there, it's a very high value for the cost.
All right, so let's just look further down this algorithm. So if the sperm analysis is normal and the woman ovulates, then the next thing we recommend testing is tubal patency, but this is yet another thing that's commonly all done at the same time. So in other words, if I want to go see a shotgun type of fertility specialist after a year of not getting pregnant, then I'd get this huge lab workup, I'd get a test for tubal patency at the same time that my partner's getting a sperm analysis, rather than doing all of that stuff in a stepwise manner.
Yeah. And I also, again, I don't think that's unreasonable for this couple that we're talking about who they don't have on history, they don't have an obvious answer, and they have infertility after a year of trying. It's certainly not unreasonable to do the tubal analysis at the same time. But like I said a second ago, if you're seeing someone who's been trying for 4 months and she's only had one period and she clearly has an ovulation disorder, and that's probably why she's infertile, the father of her partner has a child by a previous patient, all these sorts of things. Well, it's perfectly reasonable to give her clomiphene or letrozole to induce ovulation without doing a test of tubal patency. You're not going to hurt anything except a few months of wasted time, perhaps. And if there's no history to suggest that the tubes may be an issue, that's going to save them a lot of money. I also think that if someone previously had an intrauterine pregnancy that they conceived with either spontaneously or with ovulation induction the last time, or even an IUI, then obviously they had at least one functioning tube then. In the absence of any significant interim changes, that would further lower my suspicion for a blockage. Many patients simply, again, don't have the money for a hysterosalpingogram. But certainly for the person who's ovulating and for whom a sperm analysis is normal, then testing for tubal patency is a must. Now, when you're at the reproductive endocrinologist's office and they're thinking about how expensive some of the treatments are that they may go on to recommend, like monthly intrauterine inseminations or gonadotropin cycles, then it certainly makes sense to make sure that there's a patent fallopian tube before you spend a whole bunch of money on treatments that require there being a patent fallopian tube. So that's, again, one of the reasons why this gets done fairly early on. The cost of testing for tubal patency is certainly much lower than the cost of doing a few or several cycles of ovulation induction with IUI or things like that. So it'd be a shame to waste several thousand dollars on those treatments when you never had a chance of it working because there wasn't a patent tube. The same logic would apply to same-sex couples who are going straight to IUI. The sperm can be very expensive, $2,000 a pop sometimes, plus the meds, plus everything else. So yeah, it makes sense to make sure that the tube is patent with a test that costs a few hundred dollars rather than several hundred dollars for an IUI plus however much each donor sperm might cost. But if someone comes to my office with limited financial means, and it's pretty clear that their problem is they're not ovulating, and they don't really have the money to dedicate to all these other tests, then I don't have a problem of giving them clomiphene or letrozole and inducing ovulation. I'm not charging them thousands of dollars for these advanced cycles and gonadotropin injections and donor sperm and all these things. I'm just giving them a prescription for a relatively inexpensive medication that they could pay cash for. And for a lot of people, that's their only hope of becoming pregnant.
So they might not need an HSG up front in that case.
Yeah, but after a few months of trying, let's say 6 months, then I do encourage them to sperm analysis is definitely in order, probably a hysterosalpingogram. And I would do the sperm analysis first just because it's more economical and it's going to yield more results than the HSG would. But, you know, they save money for it. I mean, this is difficult for a lot of couples.
The ASRM document does discuss various methods of testing tubal patency as well. And the bottom line of their discussion is that you shouldn't routinely do laparoscopy for assessing tubal patency. Of course, if you happen to be doing one anyway for some other legitimate reason, then go ahead and also do a chromoperturbation and a little survey. But the idea of pushing people to laparoscopy fairly early in the process as a way of assessing the tubes is definitely inappropriate.
Yeah, I've seen reproductive endocrinologists who sort of brag on their webpage that they've done over 10,000 laparoscopies and stuff like that. And the reason they've done them is because they're doing them on every single infertile couple that presents. And there's this little thing that happens like, well, before we start spending your own money, if I do this hysterosalpingogram, that might cost you $500, but your insurance will pay for a laparoscopy. And you do have some pain, don't you? Your periods are sometimes painful. Yeah. Well, hey, there you go. Well, you do it for pain. We'll bill all this under insurance. And the doc even comes across sounding like he's a good guy there because he's trying to save you some money, but he isn't. That's not appropriate.
So sneaky. Well, and they say here too that the HSG, the hysterosalpingogram, is still probably the preferred method of assessing tubes. And many of the new in-office procedures like FemView, which is the agitated saline thing, are not as accurate, not even close. And of course, a normal in-office procedure may save you the pain and radiation exposure of a hysterosalpingogram, but the costs ultimately are not dramatically different. And then the HSG actually provides some more information about the location of tubal occlusion. If there is an occlusion, it can help localize that. But none of the methods are perfect, and they all have significant false positives, and I don't think quite as often false negatives, but definitely false positives there.
Yeah, they do mention in the absence of a clear test that clearly shows that the tubes work, a lot of times more than one of these tests will be necessary because they have so many false positives or reporting occlusions that aren't real. So the algorithm that we have doesn't really mention testing for cervical factor infertility, but it does recommend intrauterine insemination when there's no other obvious reasons for infertility, or also when you're using donor sperm. So, for example, in same-sex couples, or low sperm count might be present in the male, something like that. But the ASRM guideline here does talk about testing for cervical factor infertility, and so we should review that.
Well, they basically say that there is not a good test for this. They used to do this post-coital test, but that's no longer recommended because it's not very reliable and typically doesn't change management. And you may learn from history maybe that the patient has had procedures on the cervix like a LEAP or cone or cryotherapy, and maybe that could give you a clinical suspicion of cervical factor infertility, but ultimately that's just more of a diagnosis of exclusion. And if you move through this algorithm without any success, then doing IUI bypasses the cervix and any possible cervical factor infertility that might exist. And they also mention uterine abnormalities, including polyps or submucosal fibroids, and more rarely adhesions. And they recommend ultrasound for the exclusion of most of those, or perhaps HSG or a saline infusion ultrasound to exclude adhesions. And that's really the other benefit of using an HSG to test for tubal patency, because it also can help assess for Asherman syndrome or other cavitary lesions. And realistically, you have hopefully identified from the history the patient who is at risk for Asherman syndrome, and then you can base your testing approach on that history. So, for example, someone who comes in, they have not had a period at all since their last DNC, probably needs an HSG. But the woman with regular menses, normal pelvic ultrasound, probably does not have Asherman's.
All right. And then lastly, they discuss so-called peritoneal factors like endometriosis or maybe adhesions that might contribute to infertility. And for women who get all the way through the workup and you found no findings, this is often considered. But they do admit that minimal or mild endometriosis likely has little to no effect on fertility. And even adhesions, in the presence of a normal HSG or at least a tube that's functioning correctly, they're probably not that important. We should probably, in the next episode, talk a little bit more about endometriosis. But it just is the case that if endometriosis isn't contributing significant, like adhesions or distortion of the anatomy, getting the fallopian tube door doesn't work correctly, some anatomic issue, that it probably is not really a contributor to infertility. But it's often the thing we find when we scope somebody after this sort of unexplained infertility, and then they have endometriosis and we call it endometriosis. But the truth is, they probably still have just unexplained infertility. So we make that mistake a lot. But unless you would do a laparoscopy normally for someone with significant pelvic pain or findings suggestive of endometriosis, and you're at the point where you would do that surgery anyway, you shouldn't do it just because of a complaint of infertility. And like I said, the role of it has been greatly exaggerated, but we'll save that maybe for next episode.
Sure. And yeah, if a laparoscopy is done as part of a fertility evaluation when nothing else has been found and adhesions are present, then, as you said, they may still not be the cause of the infertility. They might just be a coincidental finding, which would mean that treating the adhesions still won't help them. So ASRM has another committee opinion about testing and interpreting measures of ovarian reserve. So moving on to AMH, that AMH levels are not the only way to test for this, and probably not even really a good way. And I think that ASRM realizes that many doctors have been overutilizing the AMH. So I'll just read a couple of interesting comments from the summary of that article. They say that markers of ovarian reserve do not predict current reproductive potential among women with unproven fertility. Results of ovarian reserve tests are not useful in predicting the likelihood of unassisted pregnancy in women with infertility, nor do they offer clinically meaningful improvement over already established pregnancy prediction models. Markers of ovarian reserve do not appear to predict pregnancy after ovulation stimulation with IUI for unexplained infertility, and extremely low AMH values should not be used to refuse treatment in IVF. They go on to say that AMH and antral follicle counts only have a weak association with qualitative outcomes like oocyte quality, clinical pregnancy rates, or live birth rates. And finally, their last sentence of this statement is, therefore, AMH and antral follicle count should not be used as a fertility test or to deny access to infertility treatment.
Yeah, it's a pretty striking statement, really, because I don't think you can probably find a reproductive endocrinologist that doesn't order these tests first thing. And frankly, all those Facebook ads are for, they're going to tell you your AMH and tell you somehow that you're fertile. So I do think that it's a sign of quality about who's still ordering this test and who's not ordering it, because you really can use it for some harm by encouraging people to move more quickly through the infertility treatment algorithm than they might otherwise. And that's how I see it used most often. I had a low AMH, so we just went straight to in vitro fertilization because a doctor told me I only had a year or two left. And that's just clearly inappropriate. So good for them to have a fairly definitive statement, but I haven't seen that translate into people stopping the test being ordered so routinely.
Well, we still have a lot of questions to answer. I don't know if we can get to any more, but I still want to know, how many IUI cycles should someone get before they give up? Or how many IVF cycles should they get before they give up? And does Clomid or letrozole help someone who already ovulates? Like, can you give it electively? And is Clomid better or worse than letrozole? And then should infertile women take coenzyme Q or inositol supplements? Because that's what the Facebook ads say. Or maybe vitamin D or vitamin E or fish oil. And then those fringe things that you mentioned, the Valtrex and the intralipid therapy, I've never heard of them. What about those things? And then what about trigger shots, the HCG trigger shots? Do you need that to ovulate? What if someone doesn't ovulate without those? Is that a thing? Or do you even need to have ultrasound when you're taking Clomid or letrozole? And on that note, what's the maximum dose of Clomid or letrozole? And then I think you've talked about adding steroids to Clomid, and how much does that help? And then if someone only has one patent tube, is that as good as having two?
Yeah, I get it. You're saying that we have to do a third episode on this.
Yeah, I do have a lot more questions.
Okay, the next episode, we'll start to go through these questions one by one and try to give evidence-based answers for them based upon hopefully good science.
We might wrap up this whole fertility thing next time, maybe.
Maybe. There's a lot of questions.
Yeah. Alrighty then. The Thinking About OBGYN website is going to have links to the things we talked about, including that algorithm. And we'll be back in a couple of weeks. Try to finish this out.
Thanks for listening. Find us online at thinkingaboutobgyn.com. Be sure to subscribe. Look for new episodes every 2 weeks.